Mr. Bernie Bowles of Care, County Tipperary, recalls knowing a Mr. Willie McGrath, who lived in this town until his death 2 years ago. And Mr. McGrath was one of the Irish volunteers who went to Spain in 1936, having previously lived in the Argentine, where he learned Spanish. And I think I'll now hand over to Mr. Bowles, who'll take the story from here.
My knowledge of him is just what stories he was telling me. He worked at Ford's in Cork, and because he was knowledgeable about Spanish, was persuaded to come to the meeting, and which was being held in the Imperial Hotel in Cork. And he went to that meeting, and probably O'Duffy was there. I don't know. He didn't
mention.
It was
probably August 1936, I think.
I wouldn't have any idea when, but it was that year.
Yeah.
But he went there anyway, and didn't want to know about any further fighting or wars or stuff like that. Probably didn't have too much idea of what was going on there. But he was persuaded to go as an interpreter. And I have only just the headlines of it, but can I cut this off to clear my throat? Anyway, he told me that he boarded at Cork or Cove, it would probably be Cove, and they were brought out to a German submarine in off Cork. And I remember him mentioning his beds were... The beds were palaces, like made of straw, stuff like that. And the company assembled were mostly cashiered army officers and guards who were either, that is, you know, policemen who were under either fired or about to be fired. Because in 1936, you probably had a lot of people who were looking for adventure. So he went off. So we went down to they went down to Lisbon. Now, to my knowledge, they went on a German, he said, submarine. Maybe it was just a German ship. I don't know. But he went to Lisbon and they got off at Lisbon, and there was some delay or some time in Lisbon to organise buses to go to Spain. And the place they were going to in Spain was Badajoz or Badajoz. And he told me that he was down in Lisbon and they were looking. It was almost time for the buses to go, and several of the Irish fellas were missing, and they couldn't know where they were gone. So Willie had an idea where they went, because he'd heard them talking on the boat about women, you see. That means women in Spain. So he went towards what he understood would be the red light district, and he met a policeman on the way, and he asked him had he seen any of, obviously, foreigners, and they would probably stand out, and he said he had, and he directed him towards the most likely place they had gone to. So he went down to this house anyway. He went up the steps and he knocked on the door, big door, and this very well-dressed, coiffured lady in her 60s answered the door. So he made his request known as to what he was looking for. And she nodded her head, so she led him in along a hallway and down along, and they heard this kind of murmuring or whatever it was down at the end. So they went down anyway, and here were my brave Irishmen with Madame's ladies, and they all were in some kind of a saloon or, you know, what it was, and they were, I don't know, drinking tea or drinking coffee, I don't know what they were doing. But all the ladies had, not all, but a few of them had rosaries around their necks, you see, and Willie saw the rosaries, and he said to the lads, he says, "What are they doing with your rosaries?" Well, they said, "We hadn't any money. And, you know, that's all we could give them." And they were quite happy to take them. Now, the rosaries had been given to the lads in Cork, you know, by the nuns who were Bless them, gone out. And so, anyway, the officer with Willie kind of texted the madame about the sort of, well, you know, it wasn't quite right to be taking rosaries for the services these ladies were rendering. And she said, well, my girls are professional girls, and they're professional in everything they do, and they say their prayers, as everybody else does, and the rosaries would be quite handy. But that is an absolute true story. But anyway, buses, off to Badaco. And they went to Badaco, and they arrived there, and they were put into a barracks. The barracks was in horrendous condition. There was blood everywhere. And Willie found out that there had been a massacre in Badaco, or Badajoz, of, I'm not quite sure, but somebody attacked somebody, and they were brought into the bullring in Badaco and massacred. I don't know which side. But anyway, next story was, I don't know where they went, but they had no uniforms whatsoever, and they went to this village in Spain. Badajo was on the border. They went into Spain, and they went into a village, and they were sort of billeted here, there, and everywhere. And he said that night, or the following night, the lads were drinking wine by the bottle. It was about fourpence in the old money, a bottle, and there was no other drink, so they were used to drinking Guinness or beer, so they were drinking wine in huge quantities and generally misbehaving, but nobody was too fussed about it. But he found they had no uniforms, and they had nothing that they could possibly fight in. But they were given from Germany, a whole load of packing cases arrived in, and they were given these uniforms. Now, the uniforms were obviously German uniforms, and they were beautiful material, but they were completely wrong in size for the lads, because they were all small fellas, you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, he said they were SS uniforms, and I wouldn't know what SS meant, but they were obviously discarded or surplus army uniforms. So Willie had to go around the town, whatever town it was. It could have been Badajoz, to get the seamstresses to make up the uniforms for the lads. So, of course, they were kitted out beautifully. And the next trick then was to get boots. And they were supplied with boots. And he said all the boots were there. They might have been, well, have been German boots, leather boots. And he said all the fools, he said, went for the new boots, he said. But we knew, old soldiers that we were, who never touched new boots. So we went and we took all the old boots. So we took them off then on a route march. And he said 20 miles. And he said, of course, they were crippled from the boots, because you had to do all sorts of things like put methylated spirits on your feet and stuff like that, the way you could walk in these boots, because your feet would be soft. That's the story about the uniforms and the boots. The other one was then, did they get into battle? He said they never got into battle, but two of them got shot. Somehow or another, they ended up on different sides of a ditch, and one, or some of them, shot the others. That was the outfit he was with. He also told me about meeting Franco's Moors, or they were Moroccans, I suppose. And he said that one day they were in some part of the mountains, and they saw all these prisoners coming along in
winding on now, so you can start.
Mm-hmm. But strange thing about this William O'Grady, you know, he went on afterwards, and he fought with the 8th Army, which I believe Montgomery's.
You said that he ended up in Spain on the wrong side, which meant the losing side.
Here, on
the Civil War.
Ah!
So that was it.
Sorry. In other words, he was an anti-treatyite. Yeah. And of course, most of those who went to Spain with O'Duffy were treatyites. Because O'Duffy himself, of course, had been one of Michael Collins's right-hand men, as it were.
But he told me stories about fellas who there was a Colonel Fitzpatrick there, and he was an Irish guy with an English accent, you know, and a lot of them were appalled, you know, that here we were being led by the English once more, you know, into Spain. But he told me that they never really fought anybody in Spain, and I never pursued the end of that story, meaning I wouldn't have known what. I mean, there are probably a few details I forget, but the things that would stand out in my mind would have been arriving in this barracks in Badajoz and after this terrible massacre.
There certainly was there. A massacre.
And the massacre was in the barracks, and apparently the business in the bullring was,
reprisal?
Before that massacre. I don't know. Quite know what that was.
So the massacre in the barracks would have been of the garrison, which were trying to rise with Franco. What happened was that the union organisations, the labour organisations, had their militias, and all over Spain, where the garrison had risen with the generals, many of them were attacked by the people, by the armed militias of the anarchist and socialist and communist trade unions.
Yeah.
And in many cases they did massacre the garrisons. In Madrid they did, for example. Mm. And of course then when Franco's army arrived, they took vengeance.
But anyway, just to get back to Willie McGrath, his son Brian lives up the road here. He's a bit odd. I mean, that would be saying fairly mildly. But he worked in Manchester for Birmingham, he was a pathologist, he's a doctor, and I said to him, there's a professor interested in, you know, your dad's history about the O'Duffy thing, and he said, I don't want to talk about that.
No, doesn't surprise me.
I said, why? He said, you know, that's something else. Because he was born in the Argentine, this guy. He had a lot of trouble in England trying to get his a passport because he wanted to go and visit his uncle in the Argentine. And this was sometime after the Malvinas conflict thing, you see.
Yeah.
And they were quite nasty to him. And he's just almost, you could say, the quintessential Englishman. But he wanted to go to the Argentine and they wouldn't have it. But he's now retired. And I suppose if you could wind him, you'd get a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah. No, I suppose in a sense what would be most interesting to me, I mean, I
he might know about O'Duffy.
Yes, but I'm going to Spain next in the spring. Yeah. And most of my work is on Spanish history and I'm fairly fluent in Spanish.
Yeah.
And I'll be going to Badajoz and Cáceres, which is the village you talked about, I suspect, is Cáceres.
Yeah, I don't quite.
Yes.
But those would be the stories of what happened. You know, that would be just the stuff. I have never remembered anything about it.
He never said anything about what duties he had as an interpreter. Did he ever say
no,
anything about that?
But he obviously, I would not know where he got his army training. But he didn't get much here because he left here in 22 or 3.
Sure.
So he might have been doing something out in the Argentine. I don't know, was there anything going on out there? But read that. You'll find that interesting. Can I turn this off? No? Yeah? No? I'll get you. Unfortunately, there's a copier down the hall there, but she's closed now.
Ah.
Well, it'd be okay to read.
Do the date, so.
My dear Louis. Sorry, Heathcote.
It's very long.
It's three good. It's three good pages.
Long enough to. I'm interested in reading it too. I'd forgotten about it.
Heathcote, Felcourt, East Grinstead, Sussex, January 3rd, crossed out 4th, 1936. My dear Louis, I must apologise for not having written sooner. Indeed, I am not sure when I did write to you last. However, Gwellhwr na hwrach. Merriam will be able to tell us tomorrow what that means.
No.
I told you, I believe, that the vanguard of General O'Duffy's green shirts were on the SS Alondra, on which I went out to Lisbon. The senior man, Colonel Carew, I had met before, years before the Great War, a very tough bird. But I do not think I told you that some of these gentlemen were by no means easy in their minds respecting the adventure into Spain. They had just received orders to go, so they went. Some had thrown up good jobs. One of the youngest, a certain Connolly, had had to leave £12 a week job at the Ford car place at Dagenham and had just been offered the representation of the firm in Northern Ireland at £15 per week. They held very aloof from the English on board, but I got on very well with them, knowing a little about Ireland and having a shred or two of Gaelic left, which is about all they had left too, by the way. Connolly was endeavouring to work himself up to a bloodthirsty mood by studying the poems of Thomas Davis, placing the Spanish Rojos in the position of the... Sorry?
Welshman.
Ah, Davis. Of course, yeah. The name, certainly. Placing the Spanish Rojos in the position of the so-and-so Saxons. This was a fine young fellow, far too good to be wasted on that affair. There was also a Dr. Freeman, a youngish or young old man, originally of Dublin, but then from London, who seemed to have had a varied career. He had the most remarkable stock of imagination and blarney of anyone I have come across. This one fraternized with everybody and was regarded with much suspicion as, quote, an unreliable windbag, unquote, by the other Gaels. He was to take charge of the commissariat. He would have given a great deal, I gathered, to have been somewhere else, and the others took good care he did not slip off at Lisbon. How he got in that gallery is a great mystery, for he is a man of great natural ability. The party was met by a couple of Irish priests at Lisbon, who promptly smoothed out some passport difficulties. The doctor was finally allowed to stop 3 days in Lisbon to learn Spanish, !, in order to tackle his duties. I heard one of the priests tell a Portuguese official that, quote, the young men were going to study for the priesthood, unquote. The official looked very hard at some rather villainous faces and was left scratching his head while the godly youths went off in military formation. I could not help laughing when I heard, for example, Carew and the little Irish-American gunman, Tormy, so described. I have no doubt that they are in for an interesting time, but they have not been heard of since then. At Las Palmas and Santa Cruz, all the population were full of Viva Franco and Arriba España. Franco's portrait and the yellow and red were everywhere, and if there were any gentlemen with red proclivities left, they no doubt shouted with the loudest, if one can imagine people so decorous as the Canary Islanders shouting about everything, anything. Ah, he went on to the Canary Islands then, yeah. The Reds did break out at the beginning and shoot up the place a bit, particularly the best shop windows, but the remainder, about 200, are now incarcerated in the new jail near Las Palmas, where they will remain unless the food shortage necessitates the elimination of useless mouths. Effective military precautions have been taken in the islands. For example, there's a strong guard with an alleged barbed wire entanglement set over the only public lavatory at El Puerto de la Luz, and any attempt of the unwary to enter it is repelled by a charge with fixed bayonets. The officer in charge goes home to lunch on the tram. I suppose this lavatory is a strong point or something. Franco was military governor of the islands, quite right, and they show as a sort of holy place the room which he occupied at Las Palmas. He went out of the window as the squad sent to arrest him by the civil governor entered the front door. The very mop used by the valiant serving maid to push the squad outdoors again occupies a place of honour in this room. According to all accounts, Franco is a fatherly sort of man and is certainly immensely popular in those quarters. I was allowed to see some of the interned Reds, and they looked like veritable jail sweepings. As a matter of fact, they were mainly dockers, and their language was about equal to that of their English brethren of the same craft. This man sounds as if he might have been a Franco supporter, even though he's not very happy about Franco either. There are three bodies of troops training in the Canaries. One is the regular army by conscription. Another is the Franco volunteers. The third is a body of very young men termed the royalists, who wear a sort of fascist uniform in dark blue. The last are of a better class and more intelligent looking than the others. Of special fascist organizations, there seemed none. In fact, nobody seemed to know what fascists were. The troops, apart from the royalists, are the reverse of smart or soldierly. They appeared to have the usual Spanish distrust of firearms. I managed to examine a dozen of their rifles, and there were no foreign makes among them. Badly made Spanish things, all. I saw also some of the much-discussed Moorish soldiers. They were the same stamp as the Algerians used by the French as labor troops during the war. The Great War, of course. That is to say, a trained European could probably put half a dozen of them to the run. Very weedy fellows. At Lisbon, I got into conversation with a sailor who turned out to be a Breton from a place that sounded like Plogenique. He crossed himself when he heard my name, and on my inquiring the wherefore, told me that Morgan was the name of a demon which haunted his parts. Not his private parts, I hope. And it was unlucky to mention the word. I suppose he meant what I have read of as the Morrigan of Breton folklore. He would not tell me any more about it, and in fact seemed to regard me with some suspicion after he had heard my sinister name. His own name, as far as I could get it, for he spoke very peculiarly, was Kerguilio, or Kerguiliu. There is no news to give. I have been very busy doing arrears of work, including the writing of some song words for a composer of music. An uncongenial task. I have had a request for a monograph on the fairy cult that I wrote some time ago and had forgotten. I find that I have to rewrite and recast the thing as it was done hastily previously.
The rest of it probably has nothing to do with...
No, probably. For use in a series of lectures. No, the interesting thing is that... and this is all about the... yes, Welsh and Irish and Breton and so on. And the... a bit about Saunders Lewis... So, do you mind if I read this? Saunders Lewis died in Penarth, which is where we live, and he's the modern hero of Welsh nationalism.
Really?
A complicated factor, because although Wales, of course, is mainly Protestant, and the Welsh nationalist tradition is extremely Protestant,
yeah.
Saunders Lewis himself was a Catholic. A very odd thing. So I'll just read this paragraph, if I may. A series of legal manoeuvres has resulted in the transference of the next trial of Saunders Lewis and the others to London. On the alleged ground that they would never get an unbiased jury in Wales, which means that they would not get a jury that would do what the English government wants. I'm afraid it will go hard for the professor and his associates if and when this comes about. Naturally, a tremendous stir is being made in Wales about the matter. Now, this man's name is Morgan, but... Sorry?
Is there anything about Hitler there?
I don't think so.
There was another letter from... These are historic and stuff. These would be from some of the revolutionaries that we had. There was one letter in green, I thought. It was about... I might find it again. I haven't got it there. It was about... They wondered if Hitler, Mr. Hitler, would free Wales and free Brittany. I'm sure it was he again, Mr. Morgan. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Morgan certainly sounds an interesting, if rather complicated man, yes.
Yeah. But, he writes quite well, doesn't he?
He does.
The interesting thing is, you see,
that... The point about that letter is that is... that days he even corrected his date, so it is absolutely...
Well, it must be a misprint for 1937, though. There can't be any doubt about that.
Mm.
You see, it says...
He corrected